Well, thank you, Mary Lou, and I can promise I am not going to do what she just said. I'm not going to be able to explain how to do this right, but I'm going to be able to explain a lot of the questions that we're asking that we hope are moving things in the right direction. I thought Jean did just a wonderful job of going through a really complex issue and raising a lot of the key themes that I hope I can dig a little deeper on. So I'm Kevin Prineville. I'm with the National Senior Citizens Law Center. We are a nationwide advocacy organization, legal services organization that's dedicated to protecting low-income older adults. And most of our work is on protecting access to public benefit programs that support older adults' health and economic security. So we've been working on Medicaid and Medicare issues for, you know, as long as those programs have been around, really. We've been around right there with them. But in the last several years, we've become much more focused on dual eligibles and this interaction between the Medicare and Medicaid programs and real opportunities to address longstanding problems between the two programs that impact access to care. And I'm on this panel today as a representative from a senior citizens group, even though, as Jean talked about, the panel is more focused on how these changes impact younger Medicare beneficiaries, younger people with disabilities, because we've really been working to identify the fact that the senior community and the disability community see the same promise in these changes as well as the same risks. And in the policy conversations for a long time, there's been an emphasis on how the two populations are different, which is appropriate, you know, designing programs to meet the unique needs of the dual population, which are many. It's a really heterogeneous group of people. But on some of the core principles, our group and Dredef and others in the community have been trying to emphasize where there is commonality. And I think it's been a real awakening for both communities, especially, I'll say, for the senior community. The senior community has started to finally follow the lead of the disability community in emphasizing the importance of community options for long-term care as people grow older. And I think it's sort of a confluence of the disability community having a lot of boomers in the community that now are seeing themselves, it's not separate anymore that someone is a person with a disability or someone is a senior. Someone might be a senior with a disability. And so it's breaking down that wall. And I think as more boomers, even those that aren't experienced with the disability community, are aging into seniorhood, they're doing so with a different mentality than generations before. The boomer generation is used to demanding things for themselves and wanting to craft their own lives and their own living situation. So it's a real opportunity for the senior groups to finally take on the concept of community living as a civil rights issue, as a something that every person owns, and to push for policy changes that will address that. So we've been really excited to work with Mary Lou and other groups in that vein. I talked about the potential risk and benefit, and Jean, of course, covered a lot of this as well, that the two communities, I think, see eye to eye on, and that is the potential of rebalancing the provision of long-term services from nursing homes to home and community-based services. This is something that Medicaid hasn't been able to figure out how to do on its own, despite urging from civil rights laws and community organizations and people themselves. So this is a new tact to hopefully get to that longly held goal. And then also, the promise of building person-centered programs that are really tailored to the unique needs of each individual. The risk is that the risk is kind of the risk that we generally have associated with managed care experiences of the past. That there will be loss of current services, that instead of achieving savings by making care more individualized and increasing access to the right kind of care, we'll save money by decreasing access to services or decreasing already low provider rates, and that's where we'll get to savings. And I think there is a lot of well-intended work being done at all of the levels, at the federal side, at the state side, at the plan side, to head us towards the potential, but that's all being done under the immense pressure of state budget problems and federal budget deficit talk. So the policy is talking about one thing and the economic realities might be dictating another. So to try to get at that, we think consumer protections are key. They're going to help us limit the risk and head programs towards the potential. by trying to have the policy conversations about protections, sort of sneak those in while the economic conversations are happening elsewhere, and see if we can get keep the focus on the individual. And when we talk about consumer protections, we were first brought into a lot of these conversations because they said, okay, so we need some lawyers to come and talk about consumer protections. And I think a lot of people initially said, so tell us what the protection should be. And they thought they live in one little section of the demonstration guidance or of a state statute, and it would say consumer rights and protections, and there might even be in there consumer responsibilities, rights and protections, and it would talk about privacy rights, and you've got to help keep your care plan up to date. And then they could sort of say they took care of it. But in talking with many of our colleagues, we really envisioned a much broader definition of consumer protections, that really consumer protections means at every policy decision that you make, you're thinking about what the impact will be on the beneficiary first. Then you're thinking about the economic impacts or the incentives for plans or providers, but you're always putting the person first. So we take a very broad view. We think it's all the rights and rules and requirements that are going to assure access to needed services. That our sort of overarching goal is to preserve current protections in the Medicaid and Medicare programs, that you try to get the best of both worlds in designing this program generally, and especially when thinking about protections. We also want to strengthen some of the protections. These aren't necessarily programs that have been treating people great over the last several decades. So we want to try to strengthen those to really move the model towards the potential. So we developed a key set of consumer protections. This was all still pretty high-level stuff, but you can see the full list of bullets there. Choice, access to all support and services covered by both programs and hopefully more. Assessments and care plans, continuity of care, appeals and grievance procedures, meaningful and clear notices throughout the program. Accessible services, provider networks, oversight and monitoring, financial structures, and a phased implementation approach. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about some of these and hopefully talk about some of the underlying policy at the same time. So choice is where this conversation usually starts, because you're probably familiar that one of the, depending on where you're sitting, I'll say controversial or hot button topics of the demonstrations is they want to move to a passive enrollment model. So right now, people in the Medicare program have a choice as to whether or not to enroll in a managed care system to receive their Medicare services. And under the demonstration, people would be automatically assigned into a managed care plan unless they opted out on their own. Some states even went so far as to propose that people would be automatically enrolled into a managed care plan and then would be locked into that plan for a six-month period or some variation of that before they could leave. And so that's a dramatic change to the current rules that people have now in the Medicare program, so it's been a sensitive topic. So we've been trying to talk about choice as a really important place to start, that beneficiaries, first of all, have the choice of whether or not to enroll in the demonstration, and then that they have choices within the demonstration. So they can still have a choice of providers. They have a choice of how and whether to participate in the care coordination services that the plan provides. They can decide who's part of their care coordination team. And the idea of maintaining self-directed care, which in California is a huge part of California's in-home supported services program. It's a huge part of successful waiver programs, especially for people with disabilities, but increasingly for seniors. Maintaining those choices and really trying to get to the fact that it's the person's choice, ultimately, what services to receive and where to receive them, and not taking that choice away from the individual and putting it in the hands of providers or plans. And we've been pushing with partners for a truly voluntary opt-in model. That's not going to be what's approved. The feds are clearly going to approve the passive enrollment model, but people will, it looks like, retain the opportunity to opt out. We think in this situation, it's very important that people have access to those choice counselors, that people have good information about what choices are available to them and how those choices will impact their access to care going forward. So finding opportunities for people, even if they're being passively enrolled, for that to be an active choice. We're pushing for there to be opportunities for every person that wants it to get counseling on their decision and to be active in this decision. And we think that's what's best for the individual. We also think it's what's best for the model, that if people are choosing to be in the plan, if people are understanding that they're going through a transition in care and working with their providers to make that decision, that's going to lead to a better experience for the plans and the providers as well. So we also talk about access to all supports and services. This seems like it should be obvious, but it's not necessarily, that the services that are covered by Medicaid and Medicare now would be definitely need to be covered by the plans going forward, that there's a clear benefit package that includes these services, that there's access to the distinct services provided by each program, and that for the services that are provided by both programs, that you're getting the better of coverage from one or the other. So home health services, you probably saw Medicare finally just agreed to drop its improvement standard, but there's still in Medicare for home health coverage a homebound standard. Someone has to be homebound to qualify for home health. Medicaid doesn't have that. So we want to make sure that when a plan is responsible for providing home health as a combined Medicare and Medicaid benefit, that they're doing it with the more generous standard of the two. We're also been pushing for enhanced services, trying to think about what's the value add of these programs for the people that enroll in them. And one of them we think, you know, how do you convince someone that this is good for them is to say, hey, there's services that you're going to get from this program that aren't available now. And that starts with simple stuff that states have wiped away in the last 5 years, like dental and vision benefits for duals have gone away in most states. So bringing some of that stuff back, but also getting much more creative about the provision of home and community-based services. But when we do that, when we get creative, when we get innovative, allow plans to provide things they couldn't provide before, we still have clear standards so that people know what they have an entitlement to, that we're not moving away from, hopefully, entitlements to services in exchange for you have access to the services for which your providers and plans have financial incentive to provide, right? That's a really different model. So we want to maintain standards so people know what they can get, can appeal when they don't get it. A lot of talk recently about assessments and care plans. How do you really build an assessment process for this population? You know, how much can we learn from experiences managed care has had in the past, serving generally a much healthier population, a younger population? On the Medicaid side, it's mostly kids and families. On the commercial side, it's people with less medical needs. So, you know, how do we build assessments that really account for medical and social needs when we're integrating the LTSS benefits into managed care? And I think there's a lot of experience. We've been able to learn a lot from the disability community about waiver programs that serve people with disabilities and how they're really designed to identify the personal strengths, preferences, needs of each individual. And we think we need to build from that side and help managed care plans learn about how that works and how that benefits everyone. Accessible services is key. We talk about accessibility in two areas, culturally and linguistically appropriate services, and then also physically accessible services. On the culturally and linguistically appropriate side, I think there is a lot of room for growth. And again, if we're looking at person-centered, some real opportunities to get smarter about how we do that and to really strengthen requirements that exist today. Same thing on the physical accessibility side. Again, Mary Lou's group has done amazing work on really digging into what it means for a program to be accessible, thinking not I should probably let Mary Lou talk about it, but talking about programmatic accessibility, that it's not enough for the office to have added a table that's adjustable for people to use, but also that staff has been trained to use it, that the appointment is not the same 15-minute appointment because you'll take 15 minutes just to get the table lowered. So, you know, really changing your program to meet the needs and not just install the equipment and check a box. Provider networks are key, of course, finding specialists with the expertise and the conditions that dual eligibles have. I'm sure Mary Lou will talk about in the transition in California went through of seniors and persons with disabilities into managed care that don't have Medicare coverage. You had a lot of seniors and people with disabilities being assigned to pediatricians as their primary care provider. That's obviously not appropriate. So how can we build up the expertise and the network enough to really serve the community? Equipping the mental health and home and community-based services providers to participate is huge. The groups that have been providing home and community-based care don't have experience contracting with managed care plans. What capacity do they need to add, to be able to enter into these more complex relationships. I think down the road, managed care plans are going to want to do more and more with their providers on risk-based models. So that's something the current networks of behavioral health and home and community-based service providers have very little experience with. On oversight and monitoring, you know, Gene touched on the need for this to really get this right, and this is going to be difficult. You've got, just at the state level, we're trying to integrate state Medicaid programs, right? So at the state level, you have a pretty siloed structure of overseeing the services that duals rely on. You've got many different agencies at the state level that now have to find a way to coordinate. Then you've got the feds. You've got to find a way to coordinate there. We've been pushing for things like having an independent advocate within the models, an ombudsman that is dedicated to watching duals' experience in these demonstrations and can quickly conserve people and help people, and then can quickly identify systemic problems and have opportunities to feed those back to state and federal policymakers and to plan leadership to try to address problems quickly. On the financial structures, I think Gene did a great job of laying out the potential problems here. Beneficiary advocate groups have really been pushing for an approach that doesn't take savings off the top and does include risk corridors and other measures to try to make sure that if the number isn't right, that the beneficiaries aren't the ones that pay the price for that. And ideally not the providers either, because provider rates are already so low, especially in a place like California. That if the providers are asked to bear the costs, then that's going to very quickly turn into a lack of access. And then I think this is our last one here, is treating the demonstrations like demonstrations. Again, Gene mentioned this as well, but nationwide we've got states proposing 3 million dual eligibles participating in the demonstration. There's actually only about 6 million full dual eligibles across the country, so we're looking at changing the delivery system for half of duals before we have much evidence that the change is actually going to lead to the outcomes that we prefer. So we've been pushing very loudly, very strongly, to slow things down, to try to limit the size of these demonstrations, so that one, we're just not making too big of a change before we know whether or not it works, and two, so that the demonstrations are small enough that they can be compared to something. Most of the states are proposing statewide demonstrations, and it's therefore nearly impossible to evaluate how well it's done, because there's no comparable population to evaluate it to. And CMS doesn't seem to have gotten that message, unfortunately, so we're concerned about that. But we do think if you do this like a demonstration, it's something that people will support, be excited about, and that we can really learn from. I neglected to add, just in closing, a website that we developed that I would encourage everyone to take a look at. It's called www.dualsdemoadvocacy.org, and it's built as a resource for advocates to learn about what's being proposed in the demonstrations, and then also to get good ideas from each other. We post comments that different advocacy groups have shared in their respective states, and then we also pull out sort of the most innovative and applicable recommendations that advocates make, and we list those all in sections of the website so that people can get ideas for what to recommend in their state that is working in another state. So really encourage you to check that out. And as Gene said, to get involved. We have been able to open the door of transparency and stakeholder involvement, and we need people that care about these populations and have expertise to walk through that door and share their experiences and their ideas to make sure we head in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.